Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into the, well, fascinating and often pretty unsettling world of Damien Hirst.
Oh, yes.
He's one of the wealthiest, most celebrated, and you can't deny it, controversial living artists out there. A real titan, constantly pushing boundaries, sparking, you know, intense debate.
He really is.
We're talking about the artist behind, like, the famous preserved shark or that dazzling diamond-encrusted skull, pieces you just can't ignore. They really challenge how you see things.
It's quite remarkable, isn't it, how he consistently stays right at the center of the art world conversation.
Totally.
Whether it's people praising him to the skies or, you know, absolute outrage, his work never gets a shrug. It's never indifference.
Right.
He forces us, I think, to confront some really uncomfortable truths. And that raw power, well, that's precisely why his name gets mentioned alongside figures like, say, Andy Warhol.
Absolutely. So our mission for you, the listener, today is to really unpack Damien Hirst's incredible journey. We've gathered, well, a stack of articles, research bits and pieces to trace his path.
From his early days.
Yeah, from what his own mother apparently called a morbid child in Bristol, all the way to becoming this global art world icon. We'll dig into the early influences, the key moments, and how his, like, consistent focus on life, death, belief, how that shows up in his most famous and often, let's be honest, incredibly expensive pieces.
The price tags are certainly part of the story.
Definitely. So the goal is for you to walk away with a clearer picture of Hirst's unique vision, maybe understand a bit more about the meaning behind those controversial choices and why his work keeps grabbing so much attention and those staggering prices in the art world. So get ready for an engaging exploration of art that really pushes buttons.
Okay, let's dive in. Where did it all start? Damien Hirst, born in Bristol, England, 1965.
Right.
But he spent his formative years up in Leeds and apparently had quite a strong Catholic background.
That's right. And even as a kid, his interests were, well, let's say distinct. His mother famously described him as a morbid child.
Morbid. Wow. And this early life, it's actually incredibly telling when you look at his artistic path later on.
How so?
Well, during his teenage years, Hirst got really almost obsessively fascinated with these illustrated pathology books.
Oh, right. Not your average library finds.
Not at all. These had graphic images, you know, disease, injury, really intense stuff. And it's in this seemingly macabre interest that his lifelong preoccupation with death really seems to start.
Okay.
But what's crucial, apparently, is that his mother, she didn't discourage him. She actually encouraged his drawing.
Huh. So she helped channel it.
Seems like it. Into a creative outlet rather than just letting it be, you know, unsettling.
So he was already exploring these darker themes very early on.
Yeah.
Which then leads him eventually to Goldsmiths College, University of London.
Exactly. A really pivotal time. That period would arguably change the whole landscape of British art.
Big statement.
Well, his time at Goldsmiths led to the Frieze exhibition in 1988. Now, this wasn't just some student show. No, it was meticulously organized, high production values, even got funding from property developers. It was slick.
Wow.
And it became the birthplace, really, of what we now know as the Young British Artists, the YBAs.
The YBAs.
Right.
That collective just shook up the whole art scene. Controversial, often shocking, very conceptual work. They instantly became this major force. People like Tracy Emin were part of that group, too.
And Hirst was right in the thick of it.
Absolutely. And his immediate embrace of the macabre, it was right there from the start. There's this early work with Deadhead.
I think I know this one.
Yeah, it's a pretty gruesome photo of him, like, grinning next to a severed head in a morgue.
Yikes! Okay.
It was an unmistakable statement of intent, you know? This is what I'm about.
And that kind of uncompromising vision, it didn't take long to catch someone's eye, did it? A very important eye. Charles Saatchi.
Bingo. Saatchi, the famous art collector, advertising mogul. He essentially became Hirst's crucial patron.
How important was that relationship? Oh, absolutely essential. Saatchi's financial backing, especially early on, gave Hirst the resources, the freedom, really, to go after his most ambitious, technically complex projects.
Things that cost serious money to make.
Exactly. Many of them would have been impossible without that kind of substantial funding. Saatchi's patronage was the springboard for Hirst's most iconic and, some would definitely say most controversial works.
Which brings us neatly to 1990. 1,000 years.
A thousand years.
What was it about this piece? It seems like it had an immediate, powerful impact, especially on Saatchi.
It's a very provocative piece, very visceral. It's basically a big glass tank.
Okay.
And inside, there's a fly-covered, rotting cow's head, maggots, and it's an insecticutor, one of those bug zappers.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it creates this miniature ecosystem of life, death, decay, buzzing flies right there in front of you.
Intense.
Very. And the story goes, when Charles Tchatyu first saw it, apparently his jaw hit the floor. Bought it right there on the spot. It's just this stark, undeniable confrontation with the cycle of existence. It showed Hearst's ability to force you into this direct, often really uncomfortable look at the raw reality of nature.
Yeah.
And that piece, it really cemented his reputation, both for conceptual depth and for just, you know, not flinching.
Okay, so if 1,000 years cemented that reputation, the next big one, the physical impossibility of death in the mind of someone living from 92, that feels like it took everything to a whole other level.
It absolutely did. This is probably the piece that launched him into global notoriety.
The shark, right.
The shark, that iconic 14-foot glass tank, tiger shark preserved in formaldehyde.
What is it about that piece? It's just so arresting.
It is enigmatic, isn't it? It confronts you directly with something magnificent, terrifying.
Yeah.
But also completely inert, dead.
Right.
Hearst himself has talked about his drive. He said something like, death's just something that inspires me, not something that pulls me down.
Right.
I used to get called morbid at school. I have always loved horror films. I like being frightened.
Interesting. So it's not just shock for shock's sake for him.
He'd argue not. That it's a profound, almost philosophical engagement with mortality.
But the story of the shark, it gets even more complicated, doesn't it? Because the original... Well, it didn't preserve quite as well as planned.
That's right. Huge controversy there. The original shark started to decay quite badly over time.
Not ideal for a piece about preservation.
Not ideal at all. Hearst eventually offered to restore it, which notoriously involved catching another shark and replacing the original one entirely.
Wow. So they just swapped it out.
Pretty much. And that incident, it wasn't just a technical problem. It became this kind of profound, almost accidental performance piece in itself.
How do you mean?
Well, it forced the art world, and the public really, to wrestle with this fundamental question. If the physical object of a conceptual artwork decays, and then you replace it, what is the original artwork anymore?
Right. Is it the idea or the actual dead shark?
Exactly. Is it the artist's intent, the concept, or the specific material form? Hearst, maybe without even meaning to, gave everyone this massive lesson on art's ephemerality and maybe the power of the underlying idea.
And did it affect the value?
Amazingly, despite all that debate, the piece still sold for, wait for it, $8 million.
$8 million for the replacement shark?
Yep. Remarkable, isn't it?
That's astonishing. It really shows how much the concept, the idea, can outweigh the physical thing in the art market, I guess. Hearst seems to thrive on these debates, and he pushed things even further the next year, 1993, with Mother and Child Divided.
Yes. That one debuted at the Venice Biennale, a very prestigious event.
What was that piece?
This featured a cow and its calf, both cut in half longitudinally.
Oh, okay.
And displayed in 4 separate glass cases, again, preserved in formaldehyde.
So you could see inside them.
Exactly. What made it particularly impactful was that visitors could literally walk between the 2 halves of each animal. So you had this incredibly visceral, immersive experience, an unavoidable confrontation with the internal anatomy of these creatures, challenging perceptions of life, death, even the ethics of dissection, maybe?
That sounds intense.
It was. And that work earned him the Turner Prize. In 1995.
The Turner Prize, right. Britain's big, often controversial art award.
The very same. A true testament to its impact and, its ability to really challenge the public.
So, okay, we've seen Hearst confronting death, often very literally, with preserved animals. But then he shifts gears sometimes, right? Moves away from the formaldehyde tanks and into totally different materials.
They did it.
Does the core message still come through? Or does it change? Let's talk about his pharmaceutical series, like Lullaby Spring from 2002.
Right, Lullaby Spring. This piece uses a completely different medium, but you can argue the themes are still there, lurking beneath the surface.
What is it made of?
It's meticulously crafted from thousands upon thousands of colored pills.
Pills, like actual pills.
Yep. All carefully arranged in this sterile stainless steel and glass cabinet, creating this surprisingly vibrant springtime color palette.
Huh.
It's part of a bigger series, 4 cabinets, called Lullaby, The Seasons. But Lullaby Spring is the most famous one. It sold for a staggering $17
million. $17 million for pills in a cabinet?
Yep. It just shows his range, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How he can tackle complex themes, life, death, the fragility of health, even without a preserved animal in sight. It's maybe an exploration of our reliance on medicine, that's sort of seductive, maybe false promise of eternal health or youth.
Fascinating. And then sticking with big money and big statements, perhaps the ultimate memento mori.
Ah, you must mean For the Love of God.
Exactly, from 2007. The scale, the sheer audacity of this piece, it's something else. What was the reaction when this was unveiled?
Oh, the reaction was huge.
Yeah.
And very divided. This is that striking platinum cast of an actual 18th century human skull.
Right.
Completely encrusted with 8,601 diamonds, flawless diamonds. And it includes a set of real human teeth from the original skull.
It's just incredible. And the value.
Estimated value, a mind-boggling 50 million. 50 million pounds.
Wow. So how did the art world take it?
Well, many decried it, called it a vulgar oddity, you know, just a superficial, flashy display of wealth. Bling, essentially.
I can see that argument.
Sure. But it also attracted significant admirers who saw its raw power, its undeniable beauty even. The visual impact is just undeniable. All those diamonds sparkling against a dark background. It reflects on light, darkness.
And mortality, obviously.
Absolutely. It's this direct, almost aggressive confrontation with mortality, using the ultimate symbols of wealth and perceived eternity diamonds to adorn the ultimate symbol of decay, a skull. It really forces you to ask, what do we actually value? Is it fleeting beauty, material wealth, or the deeper concept?
From the visceral shock of the animals and the bling of the skull, Hirst then seems to move into exploring belief value. Maybe most powerfully with what some people call the crown jewels of his work, the Golden Calf and End of an Era.
The Golden Calf, yeah, that's a very powerful statement piece. It features an 18-month-old calf, again, preserved in formaldehyde.
His signature medium.
Pretty much. But with these really lavish additions, 18-karat gold hooves, gold horns, and a solid gold disc on its head bearing the markings of Hathor.
Hathor, the Egyptian goddess.
Exactly. Often associated with love, protection, but also fertility, and crucially, wealth. And Hirst himself explicitly said that both a golden calf and End of an Era, which is a bull's severed head, also with gold-adorned horns, in formaldehyde, represent the worship of a false idol.
A false idol. That's a direct biblical reference, isn't it? How do you think he connects that ancient idea to, well, to now, to contemporary society?
Well, he's not just showing us a symbol. He's maybe holding up a mirror to our own contemporary obsessions.
Mm-hmm.
Is he suggesting that our pursuit of wealth, fame, maybe even just fleeting trends? Are we sacrificing deeper values for these things? Much like the Israelites supposedly worshipped a golden calf instead of God.
Interesting critique.
It forces you to question what we truly venerate, what our idols are in the modern world. And the piece itself, the golden calf, it weighs 10 tons, a hefty thing. And it sold for 10 million pounds.
Which kind of adds another layer to that whole critique of value, right?
Precisely. The price itself becomes part of the commentary.
Okay, moving on slightly. Away from the flock. What's the angle here? It's another animal in a tank, but does it offer a different perspective on his usual themes?
Away from the flock is quite enigmatic, I think. It's a sheep preserved in formaldehyde, but it's posed as if it's mid-jump, suspended in this glass tank.
Mid-jump.
Yeah, it seems to beautifully capture Hirst's ongoing exploration of that dichotomy of life and death.
Yeah.
But the specific intention here seems to be about representing a state of being removed, disconnected maybe, from the living world.
Like an outsider.
Perhaps. It evokes a sense of loneliness, maybe isolation. And what's interesting, just like the shark, this piece also deteriorated over time.
Seriously? Again?
Yep. It had to be remade 3 times, which, in a way, just reinforces that very theme of impermanence, even when you're trying so hard to preserve something forever. The physical object changes, decays, gets replaced, but the concept, the idea, remains, maybe even gets stronger.
Fascinating how the practical problems almost feed back into the art's meaning.
Right. And then there's Eternity, one of his most famous paintings, actually.
Yeah.
Not a sculpture.
A painting. What's it like?
It features a kaleidoscope of real butterflies. Their wings arranged in intricate patterns.
Real butterflies. Wow. But the title Eternity, that feels deeply ironic, doesn't it? Given butterflies have such short lives.
It absolutely is ironic. And that's the genius of it, arguably. The central paradox of Eternity is right there in the title. It mocks the ephemeral nature of life, especially for these short-lived creatures. While, at the same time, eternally preserving their delicate beauty in death, fixed onto the canvas. He uses their fleeting lives to make us think about our own mortality, capturing a moment of beauty that, ironically, becomes eternal precisely because it's fixed in time through death.
It sounds quite beautiful, actually, despite the morbid undertones.
It is stunning, almost meditative.
Yeah.
And it got huge exposure, sold for nearly £4 million.
Okay, one more specific work, maybe, where there's a will, there's a way. This one feels different. Still tackling big themes, but maybe a different kind of commentary.
Yes, I think this one does have a different feel, a different emotional resonance, perhaps. It's another medicine cabinet piece, like Lullaby Spring.
Okay.
But this one features a sterile steel case, glass doors, and it's filled specifically with pills used for HIV and AIDS treatment.
Oh, okay. That's very specific.
Very specific. And Hearst's stated intention here is powerful. He wanted it to symbolize the continuation of life in the face of seemingly unbeatable odds.
So less about decay, more about resilience.
Exactly. It's still a profound exploration of mortality, yes, but also human resilience, hope, the role of medical science. It offers a different, maybe more subtle, but equally impactful way of engaging with life and death. Perhaps even, yeah, a glimmer of optimism compared to some of his more confrontational works.
It's clear then, looking across all this, Hearst hasn't just, you know, made some interesting art pieces. He's built an entire empire around these often provocative ideas.
Oh, definitely.
He's become one of the wealthiest living artists today, right up there with names like Warhol, Jeff Koons, Jasper Johns.
His business acumen, his understanding of the market, it's undeniable.
Yeah.
His artworks consistently fetch premium prices. Remember the black sheep with a golden horn, another sheep in formaldehyde?
Right.
That went for $4.1 million. Mm. The Kingdom, that 2008 shark installation, $15.3 million.
Wow.
And Lullaby Spring, the pill cabinet we talked about, $17 million.
These figures aren't just about the art itself, are they?
No, it's more than that. It reflects the cultural conversation, the market demand, the powerful brand he's built around himself, his persona, and these enduring themes he keeps returning to.
So if we try and wrap this up, look across his whole career, from those early, supposedly morbid fascinations to this global art empire, what's the lasting message? What is Hearst consistently trying to get across, do you think?
Well, if you connect all those threads, Hearst's legacy, I think, is defined by his relentless exploration of these big universal themes: death, life, belief, science, beauty, value.
The big questions.
Exactly. Often unsettling, always pushing boundaries, whether through a shark in a tank, a diamond skull, or thousands of pills. He forces viewers, forces us to confront uncomfortable truths about our own existence.
Yeah.
His choices are consistently challenging. His work isn't just something you look at. Often you experience it, sometimes viscerally. It makes it unforgettable. He's always questioning what art can be, what it can make us feel, often pushing us right to our limits.
And that brings us towards the end of our deep dive into the world of Damien Hearst. We've gone from his early fascination with the macabre right through his rise to become this art world titan, exploring how he relentlessly pushes the boundaries of what art can be and what it makes us feel, often by, well, confronting us head on with our own mortality.
His work, yeah, whether it's that tiger shark or the diamond skull, it consistently makes us grapple with these profound existential questions: our place in the cycle of life and death, what we value, what we choose to preserve or remember.
So here's a final thought for you to take away. Considering Hearst's repeated use of preservation and decay, from those sharks in formaldehyde to the diamond-encrusted skulls, what does his work challenge you to consider? About the nature of permanence, perhaps, the fleetingness of life, or maybe even the intrinsic value we place on art itself?
Lots to think about there.
Definitely something to ponder long after this deep dive ends.